Well, good morning. It's good to be with you. Thanks for being here in the auditorium. Thanks for those of you who are joining us online. It's a delightful time. And I hope we'll find some encouragement along the way this morning as we talk about a rather difficult subject. But first, before we go there, and maybe this is a somewhat difficult subject, there's a game coming up this coming Saturday. There are a couple of football teams from the state of Michigan that have pretty amazing records, actually. They're 7-0, if you can imagine that. Two teams, 7-0. Michigan State on the one hand and the University of Michigan on the other. Now, I recognize that we are a house divided, that not everyone here bleeds green. And I'm really sorry about that. But because I'm a pastor, I'm going to take middle ground. I'm not going to take any sides. I think it's important that there be a good game, a fair game, and a clear winner. Now, some of you are saying, but aren't you taking sides by putting a little green background there? Actually, no. I experimented with a number of colors. And I found that if I go green, it really shows up well. If I go white, it shows up well. But when I tried to go blue, it didn't show up at all. So I'm pretty sure that's how the game is going to go. But we'll find out on Saturday. Yeah, that's going to be fun. It's going to be an amazing game. And someone's going to win, and someone's going to lose. And next Sunday, we're all going to love each other anyway. Okay, that's the deal. All right, thanks. Let's get on to something else here. We got to talk about where we are in our study. We're in the seven-week study of Revelation. And as I was thinking about what I'm going to be talking about today, I went back to some conversations I've had with people through the years. You see, I've been privileged over the years to do a lot of teaching and training of pastors in Southeast Asia, for instance. Countries like the Philippines or Thailand or Singapore, Hong Kong, even Myanmar. And more recently, I was doing training for pastors in the Middle East. We'd go to Lebanon, and then pastors would come in from all over the Middle East and North Africa. And I remember one day sitting down with a pastor from South Sudan. We were sitting in Lebanon, we were doing a week of training, and we're having lunch. And I wanted to get to know him a bit. And I found out a lot about my new friend, Samuel. He was raised in a small village in South Sudan. This was a small village that was predominantly Muslim, but Samuel and his family were Christians. And for a long time, that was not a factor. Samuel was the youngest of two sons. They played with their friends. Life went on well. And then one day, the village elders called together the family and all of the village and brought them to the center of the village. The chief of the village came out and said to Samuel's parents, "If you do not deny Jesus and begin to worship Allah, we will kill your sons." And there they stood. The parents said, "We will not deny Jesus." And the chief of the village took a knife and went up to Samuel's older brother and slit his throat, and he bled to death on the ground. Samuel said, "At that point, I knew I was going to die. I was absolutely convinced that they would kill me next because my parents were never going to say, 'We deny Jesus.'" But for some unknown reason, the chief of the village didn't then kill Samuel. Instead, he simply walked away. Time goes by. It's now 20 years later. Samuel is a pastor. And he goes back to South Sudan so that he can begin his ministry there in the very region in which he was raised, in the very village in which his brother was killed for his faith. Today he's planting a church in that village, and he goes there to lead worship services. And as I listened to Samuel tell me his story, I didn't know what to say. I didn't know how to respond. How do you respond to someone when you hear a story like that from his own life experience? I asked him two questions. So why did you go back to your village? Why would you go back there? And he said, "Because they need to hear about Jesus." and about Jesus' love for them. And then I asked, weren't you afraid that they would kill you when you got back there? Weren't you afraid that something would happen and they would end your life? He said, I didn't worry about that, because I believe Jesus would be with me and he would care for me. And besides, if he was willing to die for me, shouldn't I also be willing to die for him? What a story he told me that day. I was deeply humbled to hear Samuel's story. And I began to wonder, would I be willing to do that? Would you be willing to do that? We're in week three of a series looking at seven letters to seven churches in what was then known as Asia Minor. It's a study of what the churches needed to hear in the midst of challenging circumstances, difficult times. They were uncertain about what was happening. The author of this book of the Bible that we're studying is John, who wrote other books in the Bible as well. He wrote the Gospel of John. He wrote 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, small letters. And then he wrote this final book, which in some Bibles is known as the Apocalypse of John, which raises the question, what is an apocalypse? Contrary to common belief, the apocalypse does not mean the end of the world, even though there are movies that talk about that all the time. It's not about the end of the world, even though when you read this book of the Bible, the last book of the New Testament, the very finale of the whole of the Bible, it sounds like it's all about the end of the world. No. The Greek word that we know as apocalypse is the word thipsis, which means to uncover or reveal. That's why we call this final book of the Bible Revelation, because it reveals. The question, of course, is what does it reveal? Well, it's not just about who's going to be the Antichrist or what's going to be the final trumpet sound and when's that going to happen and can we pick a date and all of those kinds of things that fascinate so many people. It's really to show us a heavenly perspective on our earthly circumstances, to show us what's going on here and how we can have a different perspective when we see it from God's perspective. And when we do, we begin to find comfort, at times challenge, and always hope. And that's the way it is for this letter to the church in Smyrna. Last week, Brady took us into the church in Ephesus. Today, the church in Smyrna. And it's a wonderful picture of how things are to be seen in the midst of difficult circumstances. Let me tell you a couple things about Smyrna, because you probably have little knowledge of Smyrna. Smyrna was, at the time of the writing of John's letter and these letters that he got through revelation from Jesus, was a very prosperous commercial center with a population that approached somewhere around 100,000 persons. It's roughly 15 miles north of Ephesus. And so if we look on the map, we can begin to get a sense of where things are. Ephesus is down here. That's where we were last week in our study. This week we're up here in Smyrna, about 35 miles, right along the coast. And Smyrna was this phenomenal coastal city which had a marvelous setting. Here's an artist's rendering of what it might have looked like had you seen Smyrna in its days of prominence. You see the harbor up here. Down here you have a theater which would seat 20,000 persons. In the center, this large, relatively open space, is the agora, the marketplace. This is where the commercial trade of the day. You'd go to get your produce. You'd go to meet your people. All kinds of things were available in the agora in the marketplace. But you'll also see, if you could look carefully, it's probably not going to be seen real well, there's a half a dozen or so temples in Smyrna. And they worshiped a whole variety of deities. Greek gods like Zeus, Cybele, Aphrodite, and then Roman emperors, Tiberius and Domitian. They had all temples there, and it was an amazing place. Now, the ruins today of Smyrna have been enveloped by the Turkish city of Izmir, the second largest city in the country of Turkey. But they have this open-air museum. We're going to take a 25-second drone's eye view of Smyrna as we would see it in the ruins today. If you were in Smyrna back in the day, you would have been known for a couple of things. Smyrna was known for its school of medicine, its school of science, and for its excellent wines. But most of all, Smyrna was known for one product. They had the import and export rights for one fragrant, valuable spice, and it was the spice called myrrh, which probably is the reason why it's known as Smyrna. It's taking its name from that spice that was such a predominant part of their whole culture. Myrrh was in high demand for its fragrance. It was also used in burial ceremonies. And if you stop and think for just a minute, if you go back in what you know of Jesus when he was born and when he died, if you remember when the three wise men came after the birth of Jesus, they brought gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And when Jesus died, when they came to wrap his body and put it into the grave, they wrapped it with aloe and myrrh. It's curious then, did the myrrh that marked the beginning and end of the earthly life of Jesus actually have its origins in the region around Smyrna? It's possible. We don't know that, of course. But it's an interesting side note. Now, we also know that there's no record of how the church started in Smyrna. In all likelihood, it was the Apostle Paul. When the church in Ephesus got established, he moved up the coast and went to Smyrna and began to share Jesus there, and people began to follow Jesus, and the church was birthed there. But we don't know for sure, but it's a reasonable estimation. What we do know is that Smyrna was full of emperor worship, pagan worship, and this would have been a very difficult place to begin a church. And we'll talk about that in just a moment, a little bit more. But first, this is how the letter starts. To the angel of the church in Smyrna, write, "These are the words of him who was the first and the last, who died and came to life again." And we read this first and the last, we think immediately of all those phrases that maybe those of us who have grown up in church have heard before. It's like the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. And it's clearly reference to Jesus, who was before all and will exist after all. But the second part of this line, who died and came to life again, we think the crucifixion, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. And that's right. But if you'd been in Smyrna at the time, you would have also heard it a little differently. Because you see, Smyrna had a history. In the 11th century BC, Smyrna was a thriving community. But then it was overrun and destroyed. And for seven centuries, it lay empty. Nothing was there except ruins. In the late 4th, early 3rd century, Smyrna was rebuilt. And there is archaeological folklore that has been found that talks about how it was dead and came back to life. So when the people of Smyrna heard about the resurrection from the dead, they not only thought of Jesus, they thought of their own community, how it was destroyed and rebuilt. And we read on. "I know your afflictions and your poverty, yet you are rich. I know about the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan." Whoa. Okay, let's just stop and take a breath here for a minute. Because we start talking about the synagogue of Satan, that's a little unnerving. We'll start up here. I know. Jesus, who's writing this letter to the church in Smyrna, says, I know. I know, which is not the same as I see. I know means that there's an understanding level. There's an awareness that goes beyond that. When Betty Jo and I have been down in the DR with our teams from Keystone, serving down in El Cacique, when you drive in, you see the poverty of that area. But when you sit down with the children, when you talk to the women in the sewing program, when you take a tour of the village and look into the houses, you know the poverty of that village. Because now it moves from your head, I see it, to your heart, where I feel it. Jesus said, I know your afflictions, or sufferings, or tribulations. It's an interesting Greek word, and I actually jumped the gun here a little bit. The Greek word here fits in, not earlier, so scratch that part from your memory. Thipsis means affliction. And it's a Greek word to crush, press, or compress. Afflictions means to be pressed down, crushed down. In fact, the Romans had a form of torture that used this very concept. If a man was to be punished and killed eventually, they would lay him out on a slab, and then they would place a weight on his chest, and he'd find it difficult to breathe. And then they'd place a second weight on his chest and watch him struggle even more to breathe. And they would put more weights on his chest until he could no longer breathe at all. They literally were squeezing the life out of an individual. Jesus said, I know your afflictions. I know what's squeezing the life out of you. And as we begin to look at it, we begin to understand exactly what those afflictions are. The first one is poverty. When we look back to this verse, I know your poverty, yet you are rich. What an ironic statement. I mean, I know your poverty, you're poor, yet you're rich. That doesn't seem to make sense to us. Understand that to take a stand for Jesus in Smyrna, where it was full of emperor worship, where you had to offer sacrifices at the temple to the emperor, where you had to declare that Caesar is Lord, if you're going to be a Christian, you can't do any of that. You're not going to offer sacrifices to a false god, and you're certainly not going to say that Caesar is Lord when Jesus is Lord. And so we find ourselves now with these people of Smyrna. To follow Jesus cost them something. They were not able to buy and sell in the marketplace. They were not able to join the guilds, the craftsmen, which meant that they could not earn a living. It doomed them to poverty. And yet, Jesus said, yet you are rich. Obviously not materially, but in terms of something else. James, the brother of Jesus, wrote a letter to a group of believers, and he said this about the topic that we're talking of. He said, listen, my dear brothers and sisters, has not God chosen those who are poor in the eyes of the world, people of Smyrna, to be rich in faith and to inherit the kingdom he promised those who love him? There can be poverty, yet richness, when we take our eyes off of our material situation and look from God's perspective at the bigger picture of what's going on. The believers in Smyrna may have been poor, but they were rich in faith. They were resting in his care. And they were willing to endure this temporary discomfort, this momentary issue, as they looked ahead to the kingdom that awaited them. Betty Jo and I, a number of years ago, were in Bosnia, in the city of Sarajevo. It's a few years after the war there, and you could still see pockmarked buildings from all the shells that had struck the buildings. And as you walked along the sidewalks, you'd see roses that had been painted onto the sidewalk, because that's where someone died, killed by a sniper shooting from the hills. And there we met Elma. Elma was an elderly woman, loved Jesus with all of her heart. Elma was poor. when she invited us into her home one day, it's three rooms, a bedroom, a kitchen, and a sitting room. And she served us coffee, good Bosnian coffee, the kind of stuff that a pinch between your cheek and gum will hold you all day. Great coffee. We sat there with Alma, who is terribly poor, who heats her house with coal when she can get it in the wintertime, or she scrounges sticks and logs. But her love for Jesus was real, and she never once complained about what she didn't have, because she was so full of what she did have through faith in Jesus. That's the kind of thing we're talking about with the people of Smyrna. And then, if poverty is the first weight that presses in on them, we learn about the second weight. And again, I know your afflictions, your poverty, yet you are rich. I know about the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. This is the second weight, the second affliction, slander. There was a large Jewish community in Smyrna, and they had worked out a deal with the Roman government. They couldn't worship the emperor. They knew that. But they worked out this deal which said that we will offer sacrifices to honor the emperor. Not to worship him, but to honor him. That was the deal that they made as a way of getting around the rules. And they lived very comfortably in that relationship with Rome. But then the church begins to grow. And as the church begins to grow, the Jews begin to feel like they're liable to be drawn into that in front of the Roman government. So then they have to do something to put this Christian church in its place. They decide that they will talk about them as if they're cannibals, because they have this meal in which they eat the body and drink the blood of someone named Jesus. And they say, you need to know they're disloyal to the state, because they will not swear allegiance to Caesar, only to Jesus. Jesus, the head of the church, then makes that damning statement that they say they are Jews, but they are not. They are of the synagogue of Satan. And essentially he's saying, pay them no mind. They follow the deceiver, which is what Satan means, the deceiver. And they themselves are deceiving. Ignore them. Pay no attention to them. Then we're told the third pressure that's weighing in on them. So we read on. Do not be afraid of what you are about to suffer. Think about that. Do not be afraid of what you are about to suffer. I tell you, the devil will put some of you in prison to test you, and you will suffer persecution for 10 days, which is not an exact 10 days, it's a short period of time. And then it says, be faithful even to the point of death, and I will give you life as your victor's crown. There we have it. Prison, persecution, and death. The final weights that squeeze the life out of the believers in Smyrna. It seems unrealistic to say don't be afraid of all of that. If that were confronting us, we would probably be tripped up by a lot of fear. Prison, suffering, death. How is it even possible? Well, the people of that day would have known the Old Testament book of Isaiah. And one of my favorite verses in that Old Testament book, Isaiah, says this. So do not fear, God is speaking. So do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you and help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. So do not fear, God says. No matter how overwhelming the situation, no matter how alone we may feel, no matter how hard the moment, we are never alone. As followers of Jesus, he is always with us. And we are never left to just our own resources. He is there to strengthen us and to help us and to hold us. Now you're thinking, oh, that's really nice talk, Bob. But you don't know my situation. I think this is a bit of a reach. Well, let me tell you one quick story. 14 months ago, our son-in-law, Scott, 41 years old, was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer. 2.5 months ago, we had his funeral. He didn't quite make it a year. But I will tell you this. Scott never complained about the fact that he had cancer or that it could possibly take his life. I never saw fear in him because there was trust in God. There was this confident trust that Jesus would be with him and would help him. And we saw that happen time and time and time again over the course of that year. God gave him strength as he went through chemotherapy and the brutal side effects of chemotherapy. God helped him as he did his best to be present with his wife and his four kids, even though physically he was weak and exhausted and ever so sick. And most importantly, God held him. God held him in those final days as his body began to fail, and in those moments as he breathed his last earthly breath. And here's the best part. I believe, on the basis of what we're reading here and what we read elsewhere in the Bible, that when Scott passed away, his faithfulness, his trust in Jesus through the suffering resulted not just in the end of his life, but more importantly, resulted in him getting that victor's crown that Jesus talked about for the people of Smyrna. We often say or hear things like, he lost his battle with cancer. She died at the end of a fight with COVID. On a human level, that's all true. But that's only because we tend to think too much that life is only what we experience here in this world. There's another perspective, a bigger perspective. And we need to see it. We need to believe it. Here's what we read. The experience that we see on this earth is an ironic victory when, through faith and obedience, what we see as an earthly defeat in death actually results in a heavenly victory and life. If this is all there is, as the Apostle Paul would write in one of his letters, we are of men to be most dismayed. Through faith and obedience, when death comes, it's not the end. Through faith and obedience in Jesus, when death comes, there is actually heavenly victory and life. And that's the hope that we have. That's why we can endure suffering with a new perspective, with a new hopeful perspective. The letter to the church in Smyrna ends this way. Whoever has ears to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who is victorious will not be hurt at all by the second death. Not only do we have this victory crown, this wreath that is ours because of our faith and obedience, we also have no fear of the judgment of the second death. And so we die in confidence, we die in peace. We die with the hope of heaven deep within us. When we trust Jesus, when we hold firm to our faith despite the suffering, this is all that we will receive: the crown and a place in heaven. In this life, suffering is inevitable. It is inevitable. We may not experience what the people of Smyrna experienced. We may not experience the kind of suffering that they had, but we will have suffering. It just comes in a different package. It could be cancer, divorce, an unplanned, unexpected job loss. It can be the death of a child, like Jan and Marty experienced. It can be depression that grips you for months and years. It can be a chronic illness that inhibits your ability to function normally. It can be a child with different issues in life, autism, birth defects, a variety of things. It can be a business failure. It can be any form of suffering. We are not exempt. The question is this: how will you choose to view your suffering? That's a huge question. And you need to think carefully about the answer. How will you choose to view your suffering? Some simply say, why me? It's not fair. I hate God. Or others say, I'm going to take this. I don't understand it, and I don't even like it. But through faith, I believe that there's a bigger perspective, Through obedience, I believe God will be honored. God's love is with me. God's love cares for me. I will trust him because this life is not all there is. Which leaves us with our big idea for today. A bigger perspective helps us to suffer better. A bigger perspective helps us to suffer better. This is not all there is. As Betty Jo and I were talking this week, reflecting on Scott and all that he went through and what Sarah and the kids have been through and are going through, even what we're going through. And we're thinking about this teaching. I said to her, you know, in the span of eternity, Scott's suffering was a moment. Just a moment. It felt like forever that year. It was just a moment. And there's so much more, so much better if we have faith and choose to walk in trust with Jesus. Because in the end, a bigger perspective helps us to suffer better. Would you stand, please, as we close in prayer? Father, no one here, myself included, likes suffering. We don't want to suffer. We want to escape it as best we can, as quickly as possible. And yet suffering is inevitable. Thank you that we don't have to be afraid because you are with us. You will help us, strengthen us, and hold us. And that even if our suffering results in the end of this earthly life, because we have faith in Jesus, there is this promise of a home, a place with him. What an encouragement that must have been to the people of Smyrna as they struggled under the weight of their afflictions. And what an encouragement it is for us. Help us to live in the light of that truth today, this week, this year, the rest of our lives. May this bigger perspective help us to suffer better. I pray this in the strong, faithful name of Jesus. And all God's people said, amen. Thank you.